from Illinois Public Media. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we begin today with Governor J.B. Pritzker. The Democrat began his second term earlier this year. He's continued to focus his attention on issues such as abortion and firearms and trying to make Illinois a hub for EV manufacturing. But he's also had to respond to problems that have not always been at the top of his public agenda. Lately, that includes troubling conditions in Illinois prisons and at the developmental and mental health centers across the state. We wanted to talk to him about many of these issues and more, so last Thursday morning, I traveled to the governor's mansion in downtown Springfield. I should note that this was before the Illinois Supreme Court ruling on assault weapons and before the governor's veto of legislation on nuclear power, so neither of those important topics came up. I'm sure we'll be discussing them on future programs, but we did get to talk about global warming, infrastructure, prisons and mental health care, and a range of other issues, including his place in national politics. As always, our email address, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org.
Governor Pritzker, thank you for making time to be with us on The 21st Show.
Glad to be with you.
So I want to begin with global warming. The big federal infrastructure law had lots of money to address this threat, but the Washington Post recently reported that many states, including Illinois, shifted millions in infrastructure money away from global warming and into general purpose highway construction accounts. Illinois is said to have shifted more than $39 million. What is that money? Why, I guess?
Well, let's back up and recognize that we're putting hundreds of millions of dollars into fighting climate change here in Illinois. So focusing on this one program where, by the way, for many years, states across the country have been allocating, as the federal government allows, from that program to things that states have a higher priority for in that year. Also remember that when you're spending money at the state level and the federal government hands you money to do the same thing, it also gives you the flexibility to say, okay, if you're already spending the money in a certain way that's helping to fight climate change, you're allowed to spend it in other ways. So I'm actually pleased with what we're doing. We're one of the most progressive states in terms of fighting climate change, making sure that we're aggressively meeting the goals that we've set for ourselves so that we're fossil fuel free by 2050 in the production of energy.
We've talked before, I think it was December a couple of years ago, about that $217 million to rebuild the I-57-74 interchange in Champaign. And rather than sort of retreading that tire, I want to ask about Interstate 55 and the lane expansion. There's plans here in Springfield. I know there's legislation on your desk, at least last I checked, to do a public-private partnership toll road in Chicagoland. I guess, first off, are you going to sign that into law?
Still looking at it. You know, I'm listening to a lot of folks on both sides of that. I'm not opposed to public-private partnerships, but I want to make sure that this meets what I think the goals are for our state and, you know, ask the question, who should be managing if we did build that road? Who should be managing it? Is that the tollway authority or somebody else? And so those are things that I'm considering at the moment. But if you're asking me about whether we ought to be expanding our roads, I know that there are people who think that if we don't expand roads, that we will keep congestion down or people from getting into their cars. The reality is we need to do both. We need to encourage people not to drive when they can take public transportation. We also need to make it easy for people to drive who must. And as you know, in much of the state, there really isn't a lot of public transportation. And so we need to allow for people who live in rural or in exurban areas to be able to get where they need to go on a road that isn't going to cause them hundreds of dollars of damage to their car every year and that will be such that traffic won't be impeding them from the productivity that they want to have at their jobs.
I'm sure you hear from all sides on this, labor that wants the construction opportunities, the environmentalists who point out things like a Union of Concerned Scientists found that Black and Latino Illinoisans breathe about 20% more particulate matter from tailpipe emissions than the average Illinoisan. How does, you know, more lanes through the west side of Chicago help address that inequality?
Well, I want to make sure everybody knows, unfortunately, we're not alone in this fact that you just cited across the country. I think it's a function of, well, it starts with sort of redlining with regard to the building of roads and so on. And we can't, unfortunately, undo a lot of that. You know, rerouting I-90 or rerouting I-55 would be a, you know, an endeavor that we do not have the resources to do. We also want to make sure, though, that we're taking off the road cars that are causing the kind of pollution that you're talking about and encouraging people to get into cars that aren't going to cause that kind of, that's a better solution to, in my mind, than trying to, you know, reroute roads or, you know, change the way people live in a massive way. We can't do that quickly. So that's why we're encouraging people to buy electric vehicles, and we're encouraging people to build charging stations across the state of Illinois so that it's much easier for people. And then, you know, we provide discounts for people, rebates for people who buy EVs, and EV prices, thank goodness, are coming down on their own, which makes it a little easier for us to accomplish our goals. So those are all things that I would say we need to take into account. But environmental justice, I want to be clear, is a very high priority. And you saw that in the building of our Climate and Equitable Jobs Act. The fight that went on was a fight in part about how do we accomplish environmental justice to, you know, in creating jobs for people that have been left out of the energy industry, in out of the automotive industry, right, that could be created in new industries that are now green because new jobs are going to be available and trained for. And so we've put a serious amount of resources into making this truly equitable, living up to that word that is part of CEJA.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned EVs, and certainly there has been a big increase in adoption. I checked last summer versus this summer, we're up by 30,000 EVs, according to the Secretary of State's office, 76,000 as of middle of July. It's still a small fraction of the overall, but one thing I did want to ask about is the industry is trending toward these trucks, right? And I mean, we're all excited that Rivian is made right here in central Illinois. But, you know, you look at the Ford F-150 Lightning, these vehicles are bigger, they're more deadly for pedestrians and cyclists and people in smaller cars. I wonder if you're concerned, or should, maybe the way to say it is, should the state be encouraging manufacturers and consumers to get in vehicles that are less heavy, less giant, less potentially deadly?
That has not been, you know, the major consideration here. I understand that a larger truck or car is more dangerous for a pedestrian than a smaller one. But I think that what we're trying to do is let market forces drive the change that we're hoping gets adopted here and that we're aiming at. And the market forces are, if people want to drive a truck, than trying to push them into a car. And some people need to drive a truck, I might add, for their job or because they're regularly hauling a lot of things one way or another, even in their private lives. You know, trying to force people into a smaller car when they're probably not going to. And I would add one other thing. If you do that, they're likely to go back to buying at least their next car is going to be another internal combustion engine car. So let's let the market forces and individuals make those decisions, but let's try to put guardrails around what's available to them and also, you know, making sure that we're encouraging, again, with some incentives for people to buy the kinds of vehicles that will be better for our environment going forward.
Last thing I want to ask on this topic is, as you know, I'm sure Illinois ranks third and fourth in ethanol and biodiesel fuel production. As we continue to transition to EVs, is it time for farmers to say farewell to those subsidies?
We need to encourage in every way we can the reduction of fossil fuel emissions, and also we need to look for energy sources wherever we can that fit with those requirements. And so I don't think we're going to talk about that anytime soon. That's something that I know there are people who focus on that, want to do it right now, that we could be doing maybe 10 or 20 20 years from now. But the reality is that we're much better off with bio-related fuels, biofuels, than we are, you know, with fossil fuels. And so anything that moves us in the right direction, I want to encourage. Again, there are limits to that, obviously, and we can talk about each of the, you know, types of fuels. But in general, again, I want market forces to drive here.
I want to turn now to the Illinois prison system. There was a recent report from an outside contractor that found the Department of Corrections had $2.5 billion, billion with a B, dollars in deferred maintenance. It says, quote, at nearly every correctional facility, IDOC's operational mission as well as safety and security are negatively impacted by its worsening conditions, end quote. What is your administration going to do about that?
I want to be clear. We ordered that study. I wanted to make sure that everybody knew how bad our facilities are in Illinois, our prisons. Our DOC is managing through, some of them are 150 years old. And so it's important for the legislature and the people of Illinois to know that. It's not one of those facts that's regularly talked about. And yet with a study like this, here you are asking me, and I'm glad of it. People should pay attention. The legislature should have hearings about this. And we should talk about, do we need to put more money into the capital needs of those facilities? We have a declining population of prisoners. And we have had that for 20 years, thanks in part to Republicans who adopted that 10, 15, 20 years ago as part of their platform, too. So I think that when you consider the declining population, when you consider the conditions, we have to ask ourselves, what should we do for the next 20 years? And I've tried to run my entire administration in, you know, with that kind of thought that everything is a decades-long focus. That the investments that we make now in things like quantum are not going to yield enormous returns right away. But 5 years and 10 years and 20 years down the line, this could be what our economy is based upon. Just one example of thinking long term. So thinking long term about investing in infrastructure, should that infrastructure include the infrastructure that our, you know, 24/7 incarcerated people and the people who work in those facilities?
Well, what do you think about that? I guess I talk to advocates who say, as you pointed out, the Department of Corrections population peaked at more than 49,000 individuals 10 years ago. Now it's fewer than 30,000 this spring. It was even lower than that in the pandemic. We could have closed several prisons, many units within prison facilities, some, as you said, some of which date back to the 1800s. An advocate I was speaking to said it doesn't seem all that complicated, right? Population's down, staffing's down, $2.5 billion is needed to fix these facilities that are unsafe and inhumane. Why not close them down?
If you assumed that every prisoner was like every other prisoner, yes, it sounds like a reasonable focus that we would just simply let's close some and push people into others and we'll have a perfect system. The reality is that we have a lot of different kinds. We have people who are in maximum security. We have people who are in minimum security. You know, we have facilities that are made more for older populations. We have women's facilities. It's just not as easy as I think people would like to think that it is, number one. Number two, we have to think a lot about location. Where are these prisons located across our state? Because as we've seen in our healthcare system, in for example, psychiatric hospitals or in our need for nurses in developmental disabilities hospitals and so on, we can't find the kind of workers that we're looking for in some parts of the state. That's not a knock on anything. It's just that when you get more rural, there are fewer people to choose from. There maybe are fewer people that got the kind of specific training that you need there. And it's true in our corrections facilities, too. So I think this has all got to be a public conversation, and it's one that I think is accelerated by the study that we commissioned and that's now been delivered that everybody can read.
Is employment, these prisons are big job anchors in their communities, and that was part of the idea. Is that a valid reason for continuing to have a facility in a rural, frankly, depopulated part of the state when most people who are incarcerated come from mostly in Cook County, frankly?
not by itself. It's not a valid concern just to simply say, well, gee, we need jobs in this county over here, so let's have the prison be there. I know that in the past that has been a consideration. I don't think by itself. But I do think that, yeah, there are questions about should, for example, these facilities, these prisons be located in the most highly populated areas? Is that can we keep them secure in a highly populated area? Is it easier in some ways to put them in one community versus another to manage them? Again, you've got to consider, can you actually get the trained workers that you need? The corrections officers are trained, well-trained, and need to be, and we want to make sure we're attracting them, but they're not going to drive 120 miles to get to a job. And so, you know, some of the facilities have to be rethought, or we have to consider training people somewhere nearby and bringing people there. But I think it's hard to change, you know, are people really going to move to go to a training facility in order to get a specific job? Or are we more likely to be successful if the prisons are located in places where it's easier to hire? Again, I don't want to answer those questions because I think there are better experts than I to help illuminate what it is that we ought to do. But I do think that if you don't have a study about it, if you don't have anybody focused on it, if we just let it sit in the dark and not pay attention to it, things are going to get worse.
We need to take a break. When we come back, more from my interview with Governor J.B. Pritzker, recorded on Thursday. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my interview with Governor J.B. Pritzker, recorded last Thursday morning at the Illinois Governor's Mansion in Springfield. Before the break, we were talking about why no Illinois prisons have been closed, despite significantly fewer people incarcerated in those facilities.
How do we get from here to there, right? How do we get to your making a future budget proposal that says we should have X fewer facilities? We've had the public conversation. How do we get from this study to there?
Well, again, you're assuming fewer facilities. I don't know if that's the right answer. I think there's an argument to be made that having facilities that are less populated within a facility is one of the answers. Maybe we have facilities, the same number of facilities and fewer prisoners in each one. We can talk about the financial implications for the state of all of that. We can talk about the implications for the human rights of the people who are incarcerated, not to mention the safety of the workers at a facility. And I want the legislature to hold hearings about it. I think they should. And I want advocates on both sides to speak up, including, for example, corrections officers who know their facilities well and know what works well. I think everybody should be heard here.
We were talking about state prisons. I also want to ask you about another type of state institution that's been in the news lately, and those are developmental and mental health centers. We've talked on our show with reporters from Capital News Illinois, have shown a light on years of abuse and neglect and cover-up at places like Choate in Southern Illinois and other facilities. Now, I acknowledge being responsible for helping care for people with severe mental health problems and developmental disabilities. It is one of the hardest jobs in the state, certainly. But why has this abuse been perpetuated? Why have some of the people who are responsible for it, why is it so hard to hold them to account?
Well, again, shining a light on it, making sure that we're addressing the problem is an enormously important thing. I think that the initial reports that came out of Capital News Illinois, or at least the reporters that were involved in a joint effort, I think ProPublica was part of it at the time, it was a very important thing. Remember, this dates back many years, and the people being held accountable are people who, there were people being held accountable, you know, a few years earlier too, and uncovering the evidence, indicting people, convicting people, that just takes time. And so you hear more and more about it. And of course, my goodness, every time we hear a story about an abuse that took place, I think you can't help but wonder, first of all, how did these people ever get hired? They've been in these facilities, many of them, for 10, 15, 20 years. How did they ever get hired in the first place? How come nobody knew? for years that they had this, you know, willingness to abuse people. And I don't know whether there were things that have not been uncovered. But I know that at least what's been uncovered is horrific. So holding them to account is enormously important. It is hard to hire to replace those people. That doesn't mean you keep them in place. It means you get rid of them and then you deal with, you know, the problem that comes as a result. I think we also have to wonder about what's the culture, you know, that they created for themselves in these facilities, and then how do we change all of that? So we've been dealing with that ever since the revelation of it. And some of it has required changing management, which we have done. Some of it has required more training, which we have done. And I think you have to go at this from four or five different angles, but we can't allow it to persist. I do think, you know, I know there was a secondary report that came out that said, oh, there have been a lot of complaints that have been filed that allege abuse. You know, you have to remember that, like in many other areas, complaints get filed that are accurate and that are true, and some complaints get filed that are not. And we have to take all of them seriously and investigate every single one of them. But, you know, we have to recognize that until something is, there's a finding that there was abuse or misconduct, that you can't hold people, accountable and fire them if what turns out is it's a false report, or the report was exaggerated in some way and inappropriate, or if the punishment shouldn't be firing for something that they did. Again, abuse is unacceptable. People should be fired for abuse. But I think that there are circumstances occasionally that where a neglect, for example, is something that may have been a result of, there were two people that stayed home that day who are supposed to be helping in a unit, and there isn't enough staff, and somebody is trying hard to do the job that three people would do, but there's only one of them to do it. And again, I'm not thinking of anything specific here. I just want to recognize that we're holding people accountable who deserve to be fired, and for goodness sakes, people who've committed crimes. But we also want to at least start with the idea that people are innocent until there's some proof that they've done something. And so we're moving forward in the idea that, you know, we're going to be extra careful, indeed take every allegation seriously and hold people accountable.
Your administration recently came to an agreement with the AFSCME labor union. The union called it robust. There's a $1,200 payout, raises of nearly 18% over 4 years. I wonder if, let's say you're in an elevator with Joey Bag of Donuts from South Chicago Heights. He's not a state worker. He wants to know, how, you know, make the case to him. You have 30 seconds, right, to make the case why this is a good deal for taxpayers.
We got a better deal than most other states have gotten in their state contracts with their workers. Number one, it was a hard-fought negotiation. We live in a world where there's been a lot of inflation, and inflation persists even today. And so it's not, it's not a problem that that workers are asking for more. They understand that, you know, they're not able to buy milk and eggs and cheese like they were before for their families, and so they'd like a raise. So we tried to measure our response to their demands and make sure that we got a good deal for the taxpayers, and we did that. We got a better deal than Cook County did with its workers, than the city of Chicago did with its workers, Pennsylvania, Oregon. The list goes on, and I want to make sure that people understand that I have been a watchdog for the people of Illinois to make sure that we are not overspending and that we are managing our resources properly, and that's why we've been able to balance the budget for five times in a row now of my five budgets, and have gotten 8 credit upgrades. And I'll continue to make sure that taxpayers are represented at the table every time.
You know, going back to what we were just talking about developmental centers and prisons, do you see AFSCME as a partner in making necessary changes or an obstacle at those types of facilities?
I don't think they intend to be an obstacle, and they do want to be a partner to make sure that we're doing the right things in those facilities. And but they also know they have to zealously represent their members. If a member says, I'm innocent and didn't do this, you know, it's the union's obligation to try to, you know, ferret out the facts and fight for their member. Having said that, there are lots of things where, you know, the, as it happens all the time, where management and labor, whether you're talking about in a private business or in the state, are at odds over something where both sides are a little bit right. Maybe one is more right than another, but you've got to work it out, negotiate it. You know, from my perspective, an example of this is that we wanted to make sure, we've had a hard time hiring in state government because of many of the rules that are in place. Some of those rules are a result of negotiations in the past that the labor unions have won. And so it's harder and harder to hire people from outside the system. You have to hire somebody who's looking to transfer from one department to another before you hire somebody from outside. Well, guess what? We're in a world right now where we need to hire anybody and everybody that's qualified for a job. If they show up, you know, let's hire them. And it's very hard, some of the rules. And that's why we negotiated some of that in this contract with that we recently agreed to get rid of a few of those obstacles that they put in previous contracts. And they agreed to them.
I'm not going to ask you about the Wall Street Journal editorial that called you a public union boss. I'm sure you saw that after this contract came out.
They seemed to. Why wouldn't you ask me about that?
Well, because they seem to misunderstand that you get campaign contributions from union when you're entirely self-funded. So, but I do want to ask about one little thing that came in there. You can respond to that if you want, although our time is short. Once again, they say Democrats will demand a federal taxpayer bailout when Illinois pensions become unaffordable. I've been hearing a version of this for more than a decade, but let's do it again. Would you ever demand or accept federal funding toward Illinois' pension liabilities?
Have I ever done that? It's 4.5 years now that I've been in office. I haven't campaigned on anything like that. I've never said anything like that. No, I think that what I would say is, we're going to get our fair share of whatever the federal government is offering to states. I'm going to go fight for that. I have fought for that, and we've gotten it. Nobody's looking for a bailout here. Indeed, here's what I've been doing. I've been making sure that Illinois is bailing itself out over the last 4.5 years. We're putting more money into our pension systems than is required by law. Nobody's ever done what I've done in that regard. We've brought down our pension liability. We've brought up our percent funded of our pension system since I took office, and I'm continuing to focus on that. And as you've seen, we now have no longer have any short-term debt. We have long-term debt, but I've paid off all of our short-term debts in the state. It's almost frustrating now because the only place that we should and can put money is to pay our long-term debt, which is mostly pensions. Happy to do that. I think that's the right thing to do. I say it's frustrating because sometimes, you know, you think, okay, you know, we've been scrambling for so many years in this state to put ourselves on the right financial. We finally are on the right track. And I am frustrated that people don't recognize that enough. And you know, I want to help manage our pension system properly. But the Wall Street Journal, unfortunately, you know, they listen to the carnival barkers that are here in Illinois, the, you know, the spelunkers for misery in Illinois, and they cite them in their editorials. You know, they make no bones about the fact that they'll just take the made up stuff, the Facebook fakery from those organizations in Illinois and publish them on the editorial pages of one of the great newspapers in the country, certainly one of the most successful ones. It's frustrating that they do that. They don't seem to know much about Illinois.
Spelunkers for misery. That's going to go down with nattering nabobs of negativism. The U.S. Supreme Court recently barred affirmative action in higher education, as you know. From our reporting, that's more of a factor at elite universities. We've heard it's not going to affect too many universities here in Illinois, but there's this growing culture of legal challenges to corporate diversity programs and to the very idea that there's a benefit to diversity justifying preferences in hiring. How is Illinois preparing to defend affirmative action in state government, in hiring, in procurement, and even though it's been slow to get going, things like social equity licenses for cannabis dispensaries?
Well, you got a lot in that one question. Let me start with your comments about the situation in corporations. I love how the Republicans who say they want freedom over and over again, they bleat that they are for freedom, and yet they're perfectly happy to go tell a corporation, no, you can't have diversity. You can't have any goals for diversification of your management, for example. That's ridiculous. Companies should be able to do, if they think that's the best thing for their company, having people of diverse backgrounds helping to make decisions and work at their corporation, they should be free to do that. And they are choosing to do that. No one's forcing them to do that. And Wall Street is rewarding companies, in fact, for making those decisions. And they're rewarding them because it's good for the bottom line. Wall Street, you think it operates on any system other than focused on the bottom line? No. So they're rewarding companies that are making good decisions, and diversifying is a good decision. The state is in the business of doing what's right for the people of Illinois, and I think what's right for the people of Illinois is recognizing that we have a diverse population in Illinois. We have, in fact, the population that is most reflective of the entire population of the United States. That's how diverse we are in Illinois. And so we should have state government that reflects that. I think we should have universities that reflect that. We don't control the state universities. State universities are doing what's in their most best interests, and they are looking for diverse populations of students and faculty and attracting them from out of state or from the state of Illinois. And I encourage that. I think that's the right thing to do.
Your press secretary has given me the signal that we are almost out of time. I do want to ask you about a New York Magazine piece. I don't know if you saw this recently, that asserted that the most wired-in Democrats from Washington, D.C. to Chicago to Los Angeles expect Pritzker to be a paramount figure in the 2024 election. And that same piece said President Biden at a Chicago fundraiser in June told the crowd that you did more in 2020 to help me get elected president of the United States than just about anybody in the country, and that's a fact. Do you think that's true?
Well, I'm flattered, of course, that the president said that. I can't say that. Here's what I know. I worked very hard to help elect Joe Biden. I worked very hard to defeat Donald Trump. I think he's the worst thing that's happened to our country in my lifetime, if not in a century or the entire history of our country. And so I'm going to work hard once again to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't become president and that Joe Biden does get reelected. Back in 2020, I thought what was very important was helping in a swing state, getting involved in swing states to support our presidential nominee, Joe Biden. And so I did do that. I think I was one of the larger contributors, for example, to the Wisconsin Democratic Party. And as you know, we won Wisconsin by a very, very small margin. Joe Biden did, that is. And so I think he's probably acknowledging that. Last thing I'll say is, obviously that article, I think, is maybe reflective of my own hope that I can have an influence on the outcomes in 2024, not just at the presidential level, but as you know, I've supported people running for governor across the country.
That's what that means, right? Financially.
Yes, and I've also traveled to states to support candidates specifically in those states where I think I can make an influence. Also, I've been very involved in promoting a woman's right to choose and standing up for reproductive rights. I think that issue is going to be determinative once again in the 2024 elections, as it was in 2022 following the Dobbs decision. We need to solidify that right for women, and we need to elect people to public office who reflect the fight for women's freedom, for women's rights. And this is one of those fundamental rights that the Republicans are trying to take away.
Governor Pritzker, thank you for being with us on the 21st Show.
Thank you. Great to see you again, Brian.
J.B. Pritzker is a Democrat and the governor of Illinois. Our interview was recorded last Thursday at the Illinois Governor's Mansion in downtown Springfield. Coming up, the art of auctioneering at the Illinois State Fair. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.